Kia ora tātou one and all. Again, it's my pleasure as Chair of the Palmerston North Defence Heritage Advisory Group to welcome you all here today. Today commemorating the 30th anniversary of Operation Radiant, or the New Zealand Forces in UNPROFOR, the former Republic of Yugoslavia. Unfortunately, you might have been a bit confused when we launched the presentation some time ago. We were going to have retired Brigadier Phil Givens do the presentation. Unfortunately, Phil couldn't, but we are highly delighted that Brigadier John Broadley has been able to stand in for Phil, as both were heavily involved in Operation Radiant. So what I'll do without further ado is hand over to John, and John can do his own introductions, I'm sure, and welcome John.
Thank you very much.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ena mana, you are all respected. Ena reo, because you are very, very important members of our community, you have to speak on behalf of others. Ena rangatira, because you are the leaders. Your Worship the Mayor, Grant Smith, Councillor Mark McKinnon, Brigadier Evan, Wowan retired Dave Haywood, Colonel Peter William Wood, and ladies and gentlemen, it's great to be here to talk to you about Operation Radiant. All the curly questions at the end I'm going to pass to Mike Buist, because he was a veteran with us in the contingent. And what I'm intending to do, I'll push on, find the gadget, and we'll push on because of the time. So really, that's the aim of today, is to give you an overview predominantly of Operation Radiant, which was the sending of three Kiwi companies to Bosnia over the period September 94 to January 96. The way I'm intending to cover it is as shown. The soft copy of this presentation has got four slides of the history of Yugoslavia, because it's a bit of a complex area. I've managed to condense it down to one, but 1,500 years of geopolitical tension in that particular area, which contributed to the wars in the 1990s, makes interesting reading. But I'll try and summarise that on one slide. But if you're interested, there are four slides of the history. These are going to be my views. These are not NZDF views. I'm going to be pretty free and frank, and so please feel free to ask me questions at the end. I think if we do keep the questions to the end, it'll make it a bit easier in terms of the time management. But really what I want to show you is a bit on the conflict, a lot on the conflict, the UN response, our response as a country, and more particularly the Operadian operations as shown. And we'll get into it. So, the history. Long story short, the Slavs moved into this part of the world in about 6th century AD, or CE now, Common Era, and formed up, and that was really the start of the Croatia, Slovenia, supported predominantly, ultimately, by the Austro-Hungarians. So it was where the Catholics and the Europeans, and on the other side, the Ottoman Empire fought and seized Bosnia-Herzegovina and Serbia. And for about the best part of 500 years, there was toing and froing between the Ottoman Empire and the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And as you can see, Turkey, Austro-Hungary, in the middle is what we call Yugoslavia. So, basically post-World War I, the restructure of Europe, among others, Yugoslavia was formed, meaning, of course, the land of the South Slavs. It was originally a kingdom, and that stopped at about at the end of World War II, because during World War II, some of you will be aware, Originally, the Chetniks were providing resistance against the German Axis forces when they took over Yugoslavia. The Chetniks were Serb-dominated, and ultimately they worked out that they were losing a few villages massacred by the Germans. They decided they would collaborate with the German powers, because then they could take on the Croats and the Muslims and do a bit of damage under the power of, or assistance of, the Germans. The Germans, of course, wanted it bob each way, so they then sponsored and supported the Croatian Ustasa, who were the nationalists, Croatian nationalists, and they had an SS force that made the German SS look like kindergarten teachers. And they could then, they massacred hundreds of thousands of Jews, Roma, Croats, Croat dissidents, Serbs, and Muslims. That was all going on during World War II. Tito, Joseph Broz Tito, basically took power once he, with his partisans, and they were supported by the Allied powers, particularly UK and Russia. And of course, after an election in 1945, they put a communist government in place, and the kingdom, King Peter I of Serbia, who was in exile in the UK, stayed in the UK. It gets more complex. So Tito made himself president for life, and from 45 to about 1980, when Tito passed, he created six republics within the former republic, or within the federal, the Soviet Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, six republics. But he also had, there was two autonomous states, Kosovo had its own issues later, and Vojvodina. So there were really eight countries within the one country. While nationalism was banned, so they couldn't, you couldn't do your own Croat, Muslim, or Serbian particularly, Montenegrin and Macedonian nationalism, it was all banned. Tito then forcibly moved groups around to try and break down the ethnic barriers. And so you ended up with this sort of a wide variety of mixed ethnic states right across the country. However, on his death in 1980, there was a power vacuum. They had a very, very complex constitution. It was about 420 pages long. Each of the republics within Yugoslavia had its own president, prime minister, had its own government, had its own courts. So they were really independent states, but very much under the power of the iron fist of Tito. He had a very, very strong secret police and kept very, very tight management of all of the states. So when he passed away, there was no real deputy, somebody to move in, and so there was a power vacuum, and so they were sharing the power. What was happened also, of course, was during his time in power, Tito was being courted by both the Russians, the Soviets, and the West. And the West were worried that Tito was going to swing and become a Soviet state, and so the US loaned them some money. It wasn't part of the Marshall Plan, but it was sort of subsequent to. And so the West loaned them some money, and Tito sort of stayed a communist but independent, non-aligned state. Okay. In his term, the philosophy was called democratic centralism. So put that two together, it's called democratic centralism. And it gets more interesting. So, of course, as part of the power sharing, Slobodan Milosevic, Serbian communist leader, came into power, and he was really interested in trying to unify and take over from Tito and keep Yugoslavia together, because of reasons I'll explain. But he also vowed to look after the 20% of Serbs that were living in Yugoslavia but not living in Serbia. So you can see there are about 2 million Serbs spread around Yugoslavia. Of course, Croatia and Slovenia decided in June 1991 to secede from the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. because they didn't want to pay loans back. They wanted to be their own independent countries, and so they just seceded from the whole, and it triggered the war in June 1991. Bosnia-Herzegovina, however, did not join and decide to secede until about April 92. There'd been skirmishes that were happening across the border, and of course with both those particular countries seceding, what happened was within them the Serbs formed republics. So they created their own Serb areas within those countries. And they were supported by the dominated Yugoslav National Army, Yugoslav National Army, the JNA, were predominantly Serbian dominated, and they supported the Serbs within those countries. So, the reasons for the war, many complex. Basically, I've mentioned before, there was a power vacuum post Tito's death in 1980. For about 10 years, they kept it together, but it was pretty unwieldy, and then ultimately led to war. There was a huge complex sharing arrangement between the ethnic republics. They all wanted to form their own countries. The entities were important to them, and of course, they couldn't make it work. The challenge, of course, is this part of the world. It is where East meets West, or West meets East. Okay? You've got Europe, of course, to the West, and you've got the Soviet Union, Ottoman Empire, Turkey are now to the East. And in the middle, the Balkans. The failure of the USSR obviously triggered a number of actions. Of course, the Americans then started calling them the loans, and the countries themselves decided that they didn't want to pay the loans, and so if they seceded, they would try and avoid it. Nationalism was the centre of it all. They wanted their own fiefdom. They wanted to do what they wanted to do, and they were going to do it. And they were going to do it at the expense of everybody else. And of course, there was a tension between the Serbs wanting a unified country, and I'll explain why, and versus the independent nations that the others wanted. Religion, of course, the Catholicism, Christianity, versus the Orthodox, versus the Muslim, Islam. Because, of course, Ottoman had come through in converting what was mostly Bosnia-Herzegovina, and you'll see the areas in a later map, but it was really, you know, convert or be separated from your head. So there was really quite a good justification for why a number of people converted to Islam. Power and control, no surprises. Serbs wanted the access to the ports because, of course, they're landlocked up here, and they wanted access to ports through Croatia. So it was really important to them for trade, because the tourism dollars, Croatian coast is lovely. It's like it was the sort of Eastern Europe, south of France, and it was used a lot, and it earned the country a bit of money. And Utu. This, I tell you, the Yugoslavs, and I'll use the broad term, Croatians, Serbs, and Muslims, have a memory a lot longer than the Irish. They basically, and Mike will tell you, they'd start meetings in 50, with a history there according to them, and they'd start in 1505 or 1517, and they'd talk through 500 years of history and why those bastards across the other side there deserved to die, because they'd been killing each other forever and they never forgot. And of course World War II made it even more difficult, because there were so many atrocities on all sides, they all got affected by it, and that was their reason or justification for some of the ethnic cleansing and other stuff that I'll talk about that went on. So, Bosnia-Herzegovina, in the middle. Of course, it was really the deadliest of all of the conflicts. There, because of the movement around of a number of the peoples and the various ethnic groups, you can see that Bosnia-Herzegovina comprised quite a variety. 43% Muslims, or Bosniaks as they became known. About a third being Serbs, Bosnian Serbs, and about a small number of Bosnian Croats. Bosnia-Herzegovina is caught between Serbia and Croatia. There's a bit next to it up the top here. I've got one of the maps. But really, it was caught between... And, of course, during 1991, those two powers had conversations, secret talks about dividing up Bosnia-Herzegovina and just leaving the Bosnian Muslims in small enclaves supported by some of the Islamic countries, and they would take the rest. However, in March 1992, in Bosnia, there was various scuffles going on across the borders and stuff, but really it was the independence referendum that caused the big split. As you can see, it was boycotted by the Bosnian Serbs, and so 60% of the remainder, the Croats and the Muslims, voted for independence. And on that basis, in April of 1992, independence was announced. Supported by Serbia and the JNA, the Yugoslav National Army, Bosnian Serbs declared a Serbic republic. So what happened? Because this Bosnian Serbs, supported by Serbia, etc., had that superiority, they claimed about 60% of Bosnia-Herzegovina. The Croats, supported by Croatia, seized a chunk, their own republic, and the Muslims had the rest. And then the atrocities started. So ethnic cleansing, you can see about 2 million of the 4 million population of Bosnia-Herzegovina was displaced. They were moved forcibly. So the trick was, and this is where the ethnic cleansing was that you'd been living somebody, it's like living next door to your neighbour for 40 years, and on the basis that they now have a religion that you don't like, they were going next door to the neighbour and saying, you'll leave tomorrow, or we will kill you. So basically the people would pack all their possessions in a horse and cart, or in a car if they had one, and leave the following day. What would then do? The locals would go in, they'd take a jerry can of petrol, break down the door, jerry can of petrol, both floors, walk outside, pop a grenade through the window, you'd buy them for about 5 Deutsche Marks on the open market, and would blow the roof off, blow the windows out, and it meant that those people could not come back. And they did it. Everybody did it to each other. And so you ended up with all these villages with every second or third house ending up like that, basically. There, in this case here, there was a mosque out in the front, and that's how they made sure that the Muslims were not coming back. They basically blew it up, and they took it away, got engineering equipment, and leveled it. Okay, that's how they dealt with the ethnic cleansing. As you can see, in Bosnia-Herzegovina alone, about 100,000 killed over the 3.5 years. Thousands of women raped, and basically it was just lawlessness. There were detention camps. Each of the factions had their own detention camps, and we saw it on television as well. And of course, you know, one of the infamous sort of states was Srebrenica, which was a UN protected enclave. Bosnian Serbs came in under Mladic and basically told, in front of the Dutch, took 8,372 men and boys out into the woods and shot them all in the back of the head. In about, it was July 1995 when Kiwi Company 2 was crossed in further inland a bit. That was the sort of nature of the type of conflict in the former Republic of Yugoslavia. Of course, as a side of that, basically the Dutch held their head in shame. The regiment that was in Srebrenica was disbanded. The Chief of Defence Force in Netherlands resigned, and the Minister of Defence of Netherlands resigned. And I'll talk about some of the background reasons why later. So the UN response to all this conflict going on in Europe was an interesting one. In true UN fashion, there were 70 resolutions, this particular area. All had to be read because they were subsequent to each other, so they're all linked to each other, making it even more complex. So there's a lot of talk and not a lot of action. arms embargoes were ignored. Each of the countries were buying, openly buying weapons on the world market to fund their various operations and atrocities. There was the resolutions around peaceful intervention. So this was a Chapter 7, or peace enforcement operation under the Charter, Chapter 6 being peacekeeping. There was no peace enforcement to be enforced because of the forces that supposedly under the resolution, six safe havens in Yugoslavia, and I'll point them in the map later, but two of those were overtaken or forcibly taken by Bosnian Serbs, Srebrenica and Bihać. Remind me to talk about Bihać. It's a good example of the... In fact, might as well talk about it now. Bihać. In fact, I'll talk about it when I get to the map, because then you'll see why. Supposedly an agreement for peace and recognition of the four breakaway states very, very quickly. So when the war broke out in April 1992 in Bosnia-Herzegovina, the US and the UN recognised those four states 1 month later, which of course all it did was alienate the Serbs because they were trying to unify. So all it did was add to the mix. So the United Nations really did not help. It meant that the agreement for peace was really between the Croats and the Muslims because the Serbs didn't want anything to do with it. So we had two factions that had agreed to the UN coming. Not one of them did, and that was the Bosnian Serbs. There were economic sanctions and, of course, humanitarian assistance. So one of the resolutions was the reopening of Sarajevo Airport for humanitarian assistance. Sarajevo itself was an enclave, and the Serbs controlled access to and from, and that's why you had the Mad Mile, Sniper's Alley, as part of that sort of operation. The UN UNPROFOR was there to protect UNHCR convoys, again, depending on, and stuff was delivered depending really on whether the Serbs would let you through in a lot of areas. And of course, the establishment of war tribunal, which eventually caught up with Mladic and Karadzic and Milosevic, to name but three. There were others. What else was happening? Some of you recognise Kevin Foster. The UN and US managed to get two of the factions, the Croats and the Muslims, under the Washing Agreement, and a lot of money was to help there to stop it. And they got them to form the Federation of Bosnia-Herzegovina, which was two-thirds of the Bosnia-Herzegovina itself. They claimed about 51%. As you can see, in fact, in reality, they held about 40% of Bosnia-Herzegovina, and the Serbs, Bosnian Serbs, had the other 60%. Over the period, the 2 years of the first 2 years the war started, it was a build-up of about over 38,000 troops. As you can see, about 680 UN military observers and some civilian police deployed, but primarily in trying to enforce peace was difficult. Air support was provided by NATO. That was a bit fraught. First time it was requested was in March 95, in and around Bihać. By the time the UN had negotiated with NATO, the problem had gone and the air support wasn't delivered. But when it was delivered a further month later against the Bosnian Serbs around Bihać, all it did was Bosnian Serbs got angry, took 150 UN peacekeepers hostage and used them as human shields. And the same happened at Garajda. They seized 400 UN peacekeepers as hostages and put them around all their headquarters just to stop the airstrikes coming in. So basically the delivery of support of UN UNHCR convoys was done by APCs and other armoured vehicles. There were probably, I think, to my knowledge, there were four tanks in the whole of Yugoslavia, UN tanks. They were Danish, and they almost needed an active parliament to move or to start up, okay? Because it was tightly controlled. There was no artillery, and of course, no guaranteed air support. So it was about trying to force one faction involved. Complying with the resolutions, but they had no interest in complying. And they couldn't be forced to do so. So why did we get involved? Well, there was a change in government in 1990. We'd come out of the anti-nuclear period in mid-1980s, which had alienated a large military power that we rely heavily on trade and support. And the new government, centre-right government, decided that we needed to get back into the globe, into the world, for trade reasons too. And you can see that... I caught up with Don McKinnon last week. So Don was, of course, foreign minister from 1990 to 1999, and was quite adamant that what they wanted to do as a government was to ramp up for trade, because, of course, we had the mother of all budgets in 1990, not unlike what we're going through right now. UK requests for New Zealand military support came in. A letter was written by one UK Prime Minister, John Major, to one New Zealand Prime Minister, Jim Bolger, saying, hey, we need some help here with Yugoslavia. If you give us some help, we'll help with trade. And, of course, it meant that $500 million worth of butter ended up in Europe not long after we got home. Okay, that's the nature of diplomacy and trade. So one of the good reasons for deploying forces into that part of the world. We were also at the time, 1992, interested in trying to get a non-permanent member seat on the Security Council. Okay. And we did get one in 93-94. We were sitting as a non-permanent member in the council. The government were also aware that we as a defence force hadn't been getting much action in the 1980s, or really 1970s, 90s, post-Vietnam. I mean, we're still doing UNSO in the Middle East, the United Nations Truce Supervisory. Some of us went to the Multinational Force and Observers. But otherwise, there wasn't a lot going on. And as Don said to me, hey, he was meeting lieutenant colonels, equivalent across the three services, with no operational experience. Okay. So government were very aware that we as a defence force were lacking some experience. And of course, him being a former, he's a son of a former Chief of General Staff, General Walter McKinnon, he had a very, very close interest in what we were doing as a defence force. Of course, so we started the peacekeeping campaigns, peacemaking campaigns, Somalia, then Cambodia, then Bosnia. About 3 years later, we did Bougainville. 2 years later, East Timor. Afghanistan, Iraq, Afghanistan, you know, literally we were into it with the peacekeeping and peacemaking. And of course, we got our seat on the Security Council in 1993 with a few supporters because of our involvement in certain parts of, well, interesting parts of the world. So that was a good reason, a lot of good reasons as to why we got involved. We had... it wasn't only Operadian, and it's a busy slide, but I just wanted to make sure. We had about 780 in Operadian over three contingents, you know, 250, 260 per contingent. But there were another, basically 500 people, who went from the New Zealand Defence Force to a variety of operations. And you can see them, you know, all of the across Kosovo and then into a number of Serbian and Macedonia, we had people going everywhere. So there's quite a lot of people that ended up over the period 1992 to 2008 in the Yugoslavia supporting the supposed peace, trying to create peace there. Right, specifically, Operadian. That's Santici Camp. There's our Kiwi. We wanted everybody to know that we were there. Because it provided the Kiwi was one of the biggest protection that we had, because a lot of the factions had relatives on both sides, all three sides in New Zealand. Kuwaitis, Muslims and Serbs all had relatives in New Zealand. So the Kiwi was a really important part of our protection. Our role, as you can see, monitor compliance for the Federation, Kuwaitis and the Muslims, no mention of Serbs, and to improve freedom of movement and the general quality of life and people within our area of operations. Those astute of you Mike, you'll recognise one Lyle Mooney, Lance Corporal then, Lyle Mooney, who's now the Command Warrant Officer, 1 Brigade out at Linton Camp, Y1. Engineers and Sapper Collett there, and they rebuilt that gentleman's house because it had been bombed by the Bosnian Serbs and artillery, and they rebuilt his house for him. Our key tasks, as I said, Jared Woods, yes, Lieutenant Colonel retired. We were monitoring compliance across the Federation through observation, liaison, and patrolling, lots of patrolling. Liaison with two of the three factions and helping them to grow their civil and military capability. The area that we were in was one of the most successful from the Kiwi Company area because of the relationships built between getting the trust between those two factions. Our team were independently verifying incidents, and that's where Mike Buist and his liaison team, one of them, and you'll see that we had five of them, were doing a lot of drinking of Slivovich and coffee and talking to the various factions. I'm not kidding. You go into a meeting with them in the morning at 8 o'clock in the morning, and the first thing they do is they give you a coffee that you can stand a spoon up in. It was equivalent to about 24 cups of instant coffee. And if the spoon didn't stand up, it wasn't strong enough. And then they poured Slivovich, and they started drinking, you know, at 8 o'clock in the morning. Plum brandy. Monitoring compliance with freedom of movement, okay, through checkpoints, liaison, etc., keeping the freedom of movement, keeping the UNHCR convoys delivering aid. There we go, escorting the convoys. Joint patrols. That could be a bit fraught, and I'll talk about the key risks. There were minefields everywhere, unmapped, and we had to be very careful. Not our contingent, but one of the other contingents, the Yugoslavia, Major John Bryant, was in a vehicle and ran over a mine, and he was seriously injured. And of course, Captain Pete Flint got artillery shrapnel from one of the artillery rounds coming through his building. But otherwise, the biggest risk was, of course, walking around with them. And the Croats and Muslims didn't know their own minefields. The first week I was there, before the main contingent arrived, I did 5 ramp ceremonies to farewell bodies, British Brit 4 bodies. 4 of them had been killed in Garajna with the roads collapsing. And one poor old Sapper, Sapper Nicholas, Lance Corporal Sapper Nicholas, a British engineer who was sitting in the side of a Land Rover. The Bosnian Croats were clearing their own minefields. Stepped on one of their own mines, and a little bit of shrapnel, probably not bigger than a 50-cent piece, flew 30 metres through the side of his Land Rover and went straight through his heart. And so poor old Sapper Nicholas didn't make it. So, you know, this was in the first week I was there, and that was a big risk. Humanitarian assistance, as you can see, Jared Wood, and we had the engineers doing a lot of rebuilding damaged schools, and Staff Sergeant Porky Nickel, God bless him, and his team, fantastic, they were brilliant. And we did other facilities. It's about building confidence. Conducting a mine awareness program. Because of the mines, because they were everywhere, they were unmarked, they were unmapped. If you were lucky, they were fenced, but not necessarily. So the kids were constantly getting killed or seriously maimed by the mines. So our best weapon for doing this was Kapa Haka group and the guitars. And we'd have a concert with some little smaller villages. They wouldn't let us in otherwise. Have a concert and do some minor wages education. And we're doing a lot of anti-bandit patrolling, because you can imagine lawlessness around this part of the world was rife. And of course, the bandits intercepting UN vehicles, intercepting civilian vehicles. So we're doing anti-bandit patrolling on key routes. And of course, we had a group, a TACP, a tactically patrol party, up in Maglai, providing support for UNPROFOR. They should be UNPROFOR, that's a spelling error. Okay, and they were up in Maglai, further north. I'll show you the areas on the next slide. Right, the ground. So we've talked about a lot of these areas, so now I want to point them out to you. So, point to note, Adriatic Sea, Croatia, Serbia. Autonomous province of Vojvodina was part of Serbia. Bosnia-Herzegovina in the colour. Headquarters of the whole theatre was in Zagreb, run by a French four-star. Three-star General Sir Michael Rose in Sarajevo, in the centre, really head of Bosnia-Herzegovina command. And then you can see the different colours. Routes in, mainly, there were two routes in. One down the coast and up along the border through Mostar, which you can see, there's Mostar there, was on the border between Serbs and, in this case, the Croats. There's a small little Muslim enclave in the middle of it. Serbs are very good at landing artillery rounds on the back of all vehicles, UN vehicles, etc. Any other trucks going up and down that route. It was a bit of a game. They positioned rounds pretty close just to destroy the equipment on the back and frighten the United Nations. So the British engineers built what they call Route Diamond across the middle. So you came down and then you headed up across the mountains through Prozor, where incidentally above Prozor was a big iron fist, big sculptor. That was Tito's monument. He was known as the Iron Fist, and that was above Prozor. And Prozor was one of the biggest banded towns in central Bosnia-Herzegovina, and we drove through it every day. And up into a place called, you go through, I'll just position myself, through Gornika Barkuf, which was headquarters sector southwest. It was run by a British brigadier, and he was also the commander of British forces. And I'll talk about the command and control arrangements on the next couple of slides later. We were right, there's Vitez, and there's of course New Zealand on there, but Vitez, we were there just at a place called Santici Camp, and right smack in the centre, and we had troops up in Maglai, which is up here between Zetcha and Zenica, where the Brits had another 3rd Battalion. So they had one battalion around our area, and we were part of it. There was another, Britback 2, was in the Garajda, in a enclave, surrounded by Bosnian Serbs, and of course, we were, and then the third one was up to the north. Now, Bihać, you can see predominantly Bosnian Muslim. There's a guy up there, a guy named Abdic, and he was a local warlord, and he bought himself some 155 artillery pieces, and you could buy for about $1,500 US, you could buy a round and he would fire it wherever you wanted it to go. All right? Into his own villages, into other villages, didn't care. It was all about the money. Okay? Gives you an idea of the type of people that we were dealing with. Okay. That was Bihać, and they got overrun by the Bosnian Serbs when they cut Croatia in two. During the war. What else to note? That's probably... So, we were operating in the 40% that you can see is green and yellow. The pink bit was Bosnian Serb area. They had 60% of Bosnia-Herzegovina. Apart from a few United Nations military observers, we had no access into it. Okay. But the Serbs surrounded it, as you can see. And they surrounded the Garajda, Srebrenica, Zepa, Bihać, and there are about two or three other enclaves that they controlled access for any food, any support going into those areas. So you had to try and catch those particular Bosnian Serb units on a good day so that you get support into helping the United Nations forces. And the normally, you can see here, the Muslims in Garajda and Srebrenica, of course, well, mentioned earlier, that was mainly Muslims too. So that's the ground. Probably enough to just give you an idea of the complexities of the areas that we were operating in. Right, more closely, we were operating in called the Lazva Valley, L-A-S-V-A, Lazva Valley. Santici, shown here. Vitez, a couple of k's up the road, so it's probably only 20 kilometres of area. Gunnibar Kufus down here, about 40 k's away, which was about a good an hour to 2 hours drive because the roads were crap. And of course, you could see the mountainous country that our team were operating. They were full of mines. So we had our people in a old factory, wood and pulp and paper, and staining factory, and we had British headquarters for Brickbat 1 and VTES, and we were operating all the way up in the valley, and that was our area of operations. All the villages, and trying to get them to respect the agreement, the Federation agreement, and also to help try and get rid of some mines. So that's pretty well on the local ground. Right, own forces. How are we doing for time? Right, better pick this pace up. Own forces. It looks a bit complex, but it wasn't really. CDF New Zealand, Summer Fatigue at the time, had full command. The senior national officer, Lieutenant Colonel, was based at headquarters Sector Southwest, sitting alongside the commander of the British forces. So that was how we kept aligned with the Brits. There's Commander Sector Southwest, Com Brit 4. We had a contingent of about 253. My headquarters in Croatia in Split, I was OC Split Rear. That's what Jared Wood called me, and that's what I became known as. I was OC Split Rear. And we had a public information officer in VTES. And then we had most of the contingent sitting in Santici camp. Apart from the tactical air control team sitting up at Magloy, and bloody Bewiston as merry men, five parties all over the country doing liaison work for us, which was fantastic. We had a workshop of 37, all supporting what was Kiwi Company. In my case, it was Dave Gorn, was the OC of Kiwi Company. We had three infantry armoured platoons, about 37 each. The old engineer section, Porky Nicol and his merry men, 13 of them. We had Nigel and Jared in the medical section of seven, nine people, and of course the support section, all the support weapons, about 20. Commanded by four officers and 23 ORs. It was a good sized company. It was about best part of 250, which incidentally was bigger than British Cavalry Battalion. But anyway, that's another story. Okay, that's, and of course, Dave Gorn, in this case, OC, answered to the CO of Brickbat 1, so it was one of the companies of British Battalion 1 in the central area. There's the capabilities that we had, in broad terms. 253 people, 101 items of equipment. Important things to note, we took the armoured personnel carriers, M113s, which aren't the fastest of vehicles anyway. When I unloaded them at Split in Croatia, we then put a whole lot of armour on the outside of them and on the base of them because of the anti-road vehicle mines stuff, and made them even slower and heavier. But we then converted our Land Rovers, which were petrol, to diesel. Took the Land Rover V8 engine out, put 300 TDI's diesels in them. They were very quick. We kept the gearbox. They're also right-hand drive, and driving right-hand drive vehicles on the right-hand side of the road is very dangerous, so you had to take a co-driver, otherwise you couldn't overtake anything because you couldn't see it. All right. We borrowed, bought all the Land Rover hard canopies that we could find in New Zealand from all the farmers, and we put hard, because of course ours were soft, and we were going into minus 30 degrees Celsius. You can see the range of other equipment there, and as I said, probably the most important bit kept with us was the Kapa Haka group and 20 guitars, and of course rugby boots too. First couple of weeks we were up there, we had a game of rugby and beat the Bosnian Muslim team by 80 points. So the word got out that the Kiwis were in town, which was useful. And the security operation of Magloy was unbelievable. So, key risks. Faction non-compliance happened all the time. The local factions were taking the law into their own hands because there was no accountability. Serbs, they want to disrupt the Federation, because of course they now had two, the Croats and the Muslims, fighting together against the Serbs, and they were trying to break up that Federation. We had all the indiscriminate shooting that was going on. Everybody had weapons. They used to fire them into the air, particularly after on a celebration, not realising that, you know, a round goes up, 7.6 round goes up, and it comes down somewhere. Okay? And was the excessive consumption of slivovich. They were horribly drunk all of the time, and a lot of the atrocities happened because they had Dutch courage from the alcohol. Unmapped minefields, the UN or NATO support or lack thereof was a key risk because you just didn't know how you were going to do it. Banditry, mountainous terrain, the weather, you know, very, very unpredictable, very central North Island-like, but minus 30 up to. And one of the biggest risks was the laissez-faire driving style that the locals had. They'd been through the wars, they didn't care. If it was their turn to die today, that was, you know, it was the old, like, the Middle East, inshallah, it's their, if it's their will. Okay. Just quickly, key timings, just to give you an idea of how things happened. Things happened very, very quickly. So it was only May 1994 that there was the agreement to increase them. We had 9 United Nations military observers. Some of you remember Richard Gray, you know, filming, doing television from the top of Sarajevo, oblivious to the rounds going on around him. Well, that, and then we put another 250 people in there. We had an MOU with the UK government and the UK forces, and we literally, I got rung up, I was meant to be going to Canada, I got rung up, and the following day we were heading off to Yugoslavia for the in-theatre reconnaissance. Contingent was compiled very, very quickly, and all the equipment had to be modified. So we had workshops running 24/7, basically, particularly in Trentham, because we had to lease a ship to get all the stuff there. It was the easiest way to get it there. We threw a couple of our 2 NZDF mechanics. They had a ball for about 6 weeks as they toured through up into Europe and kept all the vehicles going. Advanced party, some of us deployed about then, and the others, main body, stayed back and trained, and they deployed in September 1994. That was the first group that went in. We had to build our own camp. So we put the main contingent, we grabbed all the engineers and anybody who had any skill, and we trucked them up to central Bosnia, because we took over a camp from the Belgics, and they were living in tents in minus 30 degrees Celsius. So we decided we weren't doing that. Took me about, I'd ordered the village to be shipped to us by the UN about 2 months before, when I was up there doing the pre-runners. Still hadn't arrived. We got it there, and then we had to build. And the engineers built a fantastic camp. So we were in operations there till March 95. We handed over to Kiwi Company 2, who were there for a further 6 months, till September 95. They had some really interesting times too, with bandits and Srebrenica happening while they were there. And then September, December 95, Kiwi Company 3, they were short-toured because of the Dayton Agreement. And the Dayton Agreement then meant that Europe finally came in with, under NATO, under I-4, Implementation Force, they came in. We lost, obviously, the 3 contingents. We lost poor old Kelly Banks, an engineer who died while on leave on the 13th of December, 1995. God rest his soul. And the day after, they signed the Dayton Agreement and ended 3+ years of war. And, of course, the Kiwi Company pulled out. They got back about the 1st of January, 1995, and the remainder, about 30, got everything onto ships to get everything home. And, of course, NATO came in. Right, pretty well. Oh, key lessons, last few slides. Right, UNPROFOR was a political and strategic failure, okay, given the major powers' unwillingness really to contribute the necessary forces. So we couldn't enforce peace under Chapter 7. We deployed into the air without any agreement of all the warring parties. We had 2/3 sorted, but there was the 1/3 that had all the power and had all the weapons. because they were former Yugoslav National Army. Some contributing nations, kept a real tight management on their forces. They weren't allowed to do anything or react without really almost an act of parliament, or certainly getting political support from their home country. So it meant it quite moribund in terms of complexities. As I said before, NATO relationships was fraught. As UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali, who was there in the seat from 92 to 95, we got the operations in the wrong order. IFOR should have gone in first with NATO and the necessary air I'll call it major armoured and artillery support to be able to force the factions to come to the table and then bring peacekeepers in afterwards. UN did it the other way around. From a New Zealand political strategic perspective, there was a government recognition, obviously, that we needed to deploy New Zealand Defence Force to help global peace, trade, and winning a seat on the Security Council. But this was the first of the combat forces that New Zealand sent in under UN banner. Recognition that we needed to deploy, and as Sir Don said to me, we needed the New Zealand Defence Force again to regain our spurs. Right, operational lessons. Bureaucracy, UN is unheralded. I did a lot of work in Zagreb. Fortunately, we had old Brigadier Marco Polo Vestic sitting as a civilian up there. A guy like Jeff, I'll think of his name, Jeff Bright up there, so we had some really good support in Zagreb. We had Major Steve Klarisic was at JHQ Walton. He was the original OC of the company, but because of his surname, we couldn't deploy him. Klarisic, Croatian, Dalmatian, he would have been a big target for the Serbs. So he had to step aside, and Dave Gorn took the company, and we put poor old the late Steve Klarisic, or as it became known as Steve K. We got him an ID card, K-A-Y, and then he came and visited us. We got him a few times to come and visit us in Yugoslavia under a pseudonym, and I took him down to see his family plot in Dalmatia. So it was good, but it was a shame, but that was just the way it was. Mobilisation training was good, logistics support was great to get us there, but again, I was working to about three headquarters. One of them was run by this guy here, Derek McMillan, who was doing all the ministerial support for us from Linton Camp. Outstanding, thank you, Derek. And, we had Land Headquarters Land Force Command, and we were also working into the centre for any urgent stuff. Tactical, we had good New Zealand service people involved, particularly at the lowest level. We had a lot of young corporals running checkpoints. I call them the strategic corporals, because the Serbs were, and the Croats and Muslims were, and trying to antagonise the UN forces to get a reaction, to support their agendas, and our soldiers were outstanding. They didn't react, they kept to the rules of engagement, and they did what they needed to do. The importance of genuine relationships. We got there, we operated because of our relationships. If we've got time, ask me about the Coro Club. That's how we got a lot of support, because we used to pour drinks into a lot of the other contingents that had all the equipment. And then we'd go and claim what the promises they'd given to us under the effects of alcohol. And then we had the Papahaka group and Seta Rugby that opened doors to inaccessible areas. So it was a real Kiwi strength. So, in conclusion, this is a quote from the chief, political chief of mission, old Akashi. It was a good summary, really, of the complexities of the UNFFOR. I'll let you read it. Ultimately, it was a good idea, but there was a lack of political will to make it work. Okay. Europe did not want to get itself embroiled in another war in the Balkans. They had to in the end. Despite the limitations, our contingent and all the other contingents that, the other five or so hundred people that did other operations around the Balkans, peacekeeping operations, did really well. And it meant that we were walking the talk as a non-permanent member of the Security Council in 93-94. It was very useful as an operation of mobilising us. Later, obviously, lessons learned. We did it very, very quickly for East Timor. Well, also for Bougainville too, and then East Timor. And all of us were involved in those, getting that group. And I certainly was in logistics doing both those later operations. And we learned a lot of good lessons for deploying to the other side of the world. And on the ground, our team performed really particularly well. I'm biased, of course, but I was sitting outside looking at Kiwi Company, and they were outstanding in what they did. Right, questions. That is the photo of our contingent in your town square as you've farewelled us, Your Worship, in about 1994. Support from New Zealand is fantastic. Right, I've done too much talking. There was a lot to cover. Questions? Sir?
Might be a curly one, can you speculate what the New Zealand forces' reaction would have been had you been the Dutch in Srebrenica?
I can say this categorically, would not have allowed it to happen. Because delegation, responsibility, everybody knew what the rules of engagement were. And I think part of our protection was that we made it clear we were in theatre, we had a job to do. And our forces would not have let Mladic and his Bosnian Serbs come in and take. There would have been a fight, we would have fought, and that would have been a good reason then to try and get as much NATO air support. There would have been a few phone calls made, and we could do it through the Brits, and the Brits would have come to the party because they had a lot of the aircraft in NATO. Good question, but
You had the firepower to withstand though that thousands of Serbs?
We would have done all right. We had a support section of 20 people, you know, so most of you understand what's in the support section. We had some mortars and we had some machine guns and we had, you know, sniper rifles and, you know, we had some pretty good capability. Each of the armoured personnel carriers, all 26 of them had 50 cal weapons on them, and we had machine guns on them as well. So, you know, we would have given a good...
How fast did those armoured personnel vehicles go? You said they were slow anyway.
Not fast.
So what's not fast?
I mean, 10 or 20 k's an hour, but because it was also the roads. Yeah. The roads were in ship condition. And during the winter, they were even more ship condition. Okay, so you couldn't go fast anyway. And, you know, potholes. And there were some tar sealed roads, but the terrain was such. I mean, I used to try and... I'd driven it enough, and I was sick and tired, and so... You know, I think one of the groups that we fed a bit of alcohol to was one of the British helicopter squadrons. So we were able to get our people up into central by helicopters. But the helicopters had to literally quite often had to drop down and look at signposts to work out where they were. Because there was a lot of, you know, it's high country and it's cloudy and it's foggy and, you know, it was quite easy to get disoriented. So we, you know, we dropped down occasionally to pull out the map and work out where the signposts were so that we could work out where a helicopter was.
Any other questions?
I'm sorry I've taken so obviously took so long, but it gives you an idea of the complexities of the nature of the operations in Yugoslavia. And, you know, as I said, there was another three or four slides of history. There's 1,500 years of tension in that particular area, and they've been fighting each other across the whole 1,500 years, and the war just gave them an excuse to have another fight between each other. Unfortunately, it was the civilian, you know, in Yugoslavia, the 100,000, mainly civilians, women and children, they got killed. Joe.
John, thank you very much. That gives you a pretty good idea, and I think John also focused on that period of time, the early 90s, virtually from around about 1989 onwards. Everything, you know, was going on around the world, and really from 1989 right through until probably 2000,
was the fall of the wall.
Yeah. As soon as the Berlin Wall came down in September 1989,
in the 91 collapse,
the whole of the Soviet Union sort of broke apart and all the rest of it. It all turned to custom. And there were so many things going on, and New Zealand was lickety split. We had, in particular, engineers spread all around the globe. I mean, Jeb was up in Namibia doing mine clearance and what have you with the Aussies. We also had the, Bougainville, we had Somalia, we had
Pakistan,
Ops Alarm, we had all of these things were going on. While we only had a small number of sappers in New Zealand, but all the other forces were involved. I mean, Peter, you were fairly heavily involved. Angola, we had Mozambique, Namibia. It was just on, flat out. And the good thing about it is that we've been able to portray this out in the Engineer Corps Memorial Centre, out in Linton Camp, with quite a number of displays. And we do actually have a separate display on Bosnia out there with material that sappers have passed back to us for that display. And so it just gives you a sense of what was going on at that time. And I don't think the public understand or appreciate it. That's pretty much it from me. So, look, if you could just put your hands together once again to thank John very much for his excellent presentation.